83 of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. First of all, I want to apologize for this Secret War Saturday episode being a little late. The first time I recorded it, for some reason, the audio wasn't there. What can I say? It happens in podcasting, so I appreciate your patience and you've taken the time to join me as always. So this episode, I'm going to be talking about the tie-ins for Secret Wars 2, number 7. And we're going to start with The Amazing Spider-Man 273. It's written by Tom DeFalco. We've got pencils by Ron Frenz. We've got inks or finishes, as it's listed here, finished art by Joseph Rubinstein and letters by Joe Rosen with colors by Bob Sharon. So this issue, Amazing Spider-Man 273, as well as Spectacular Spider-Man 111, are really the two issues this month that tie in with Secret Wars 7 the best. The other two issues, the Beyonder shows up for a few panels. He's not really a big part of the story. He's kind of used as a plot device almost, as the, kind of the impetus for the story in New Mutants 36. And then with Defenders 152, he kind of furthers the plot a little bit. And I'll talk more about those when I get to those particular issues. But really, when you talk about where the Beyonder found himself at the end of Secret Wars 2, number 7, which was this kind of light bulb moment where he believes he's found a purpose. You know, he's been kind of wandering aimlessly throughout the Marvel Universe ever since like issue 2 or 3, where he kind of started to understand the human condition. And then that sense of incompleteness and wanting to know what desire was all about. And just having a tough time finding a place, a role in the universe to start to feel some sense of accomplishment and fulfillment. He struggled with that. And we saw at the end of issue 7 of the Secret Wars miniseries that he had a light bulb moment. He felt that he inspired the Thing, Ben Grimm, to realize that he is a hero and that's his kind of place and his role, his destiny. And so now the Beyonder thinks, that's what I'm going to do. My job in the universe is going to be to help people understand what their job in the universe is. So that's where we kind of find the Beyonder in these issues, especially of the two Spider-Man titles, as I mentioned. So let me give a quick synopsis of the stories here, and then I'll talk a little bit more in detail about kind of where the Beyonder is finding himself these days as the series is starting to wind down. So issue 273 of The Amazing Spider-Man, February 1986, starts off with a Native American ritual. We are shown Thomas Fireheart, otherwise known as the Puma. He's previously showed up in a couple issues of Amazing Spider-Man at this point, I think. And the Puma is an interesting character. He's Native American, as I mentioned. A lot of times prior to this, and even after these stories, Native Americans were kind of shown as kind of poor or persecuted. They weren't really shown as kind of successful members of society, at least not as far as I know. I can't remember any characters that were. So it's kind of a breath of fresh air to see Thomas Fireheart here. He's almost a Tony Stark-like character. He runs Fireheart Industries. And he's very successful. He's also the possessor of his tribe's power. He's the Puma, almost a totem for the tribe. And as I said, he starts off in this issue at a tribal ritual, I think, that happens once a month. And he's shown a vision of he who comes from beyond, the face of your enemy, the mad god who would engulf this world in blood and fire. And supposedly that's his destiny, right? What his tribe has always told him. His uncle is a shaman, and he's always been told that his destiny as the Puma is to destroy or kill this being that comes from beyond. So Thomas doesn't seem to be that that connected to his tribe in a way, into this ritual. He's talking about these other members of the tribe. They're professionals, doctors, lawyers, chemical engineers. Where's their pride? They're getting into this act where they're dancing around a fire, all because of some stupid ancient prophecy, in the words of Thomas Fireheart. He's like, I can't believe that they're rational adults thinking that some being from beyond is going to come to Earth. Really, I should be home working on my oil lease, this Japan deal that I'm trying to put together. But I just couldn't disappoint my uncle. And the uncle comes over and says, the gauntlet is ready. You will turn into your Puma guys, and you will show that you have what it takes to be the protector of our people. And so Thomas transforms into the Puma, and he goes through this gauntlet of other men from his tribe who are holding weapons and trying to defeat him. And Thomas is thinking to himself how careful he has to be, how it actually takes all his skill and concentration to keep his power in check. He's supposed to be the protector of the tribe, not slaughter members of it. So he thinks, I'd never forgive myself if I accidentally hurt one of these men. And the elders of the tribe are pleased that Thomas is able to defeat the other members of the tribe. And they call for a halt and say, that's enough. The tribe smiles upon this warrior. May our ancient gods grant him the strength he'll need in the coming days. And they give him a new costume and say, the ceremony is over, let the festivities begin. But Thomas takes his leave. He changes back into civilian clothes, and his uncle walks him to his car saying, I sense you're troubled. You don't believe the ancient legends. And Thomas responds, maybe I don't, but that won't stop me from doing what you wish. And the uncle reiterates that he must find the one from beyond and kill him, show him no mercy. He may appear human, but his power surpasses the stars itself. So as Thomas leaves, his uncle gives him one last bit of advice, perhaps to enlist the aid of the man spider, whose image I recently saw in your office. And obviously he's referring to Spider-Man. So Thomas drives off, and his uncle thinks that he fears that he's sending Thomas to his death, even though Thomas is basically the only hope of the tribe to defeat the Beyonder. So meanwhile, the next day in New York City, Spider-Man is swinging around, hoping that doing some web-slinging would chase his blahs away. He's been feeling really down after the death of Gene DeWolf, which was in the Sin Eater story in Spectacular Spider-Man in the mid-80s. And he also had a recent fire in his apartment, so he's just not really feeling very good. And then he notices a commotion down on the street, and someone is attacking a couple of guys handing out pamphlets. Apparently, they're trying to pass along their message of cosmic oneness, and this guy's not having it, and Spider-Man chases him off with a little booga booga, and then feels a little bad about it. Meanwhile, the other two gentlemen say they thank Spider-Man and say, perhaps you'd be interested in our message. We believe in the concept of cosmic oneness. Every member of the human race is like a cell in a body, and we all need to work together and have a button. And Spider-Man's, no thanks, and swings off. And as he leaves, he hears one of the men say, please heed our message. It comes from the one from beyond this petty world. And Spider-Man hears that and says, one from beyond. I wonder if, it couldn't be. Why would the Beyonder be involved in some cult? And then thinks about the fact that he's been wrapped up with the Sin Eater and Gene DeWolf's death and his own problems. He hasn't even thought about the Beyonder in days. And we get a little flashback where he thinks about Secret Wars and the Beyonder showing up in his apartment and Peter having to teach the Beyonder how to go pee. And then the skyscraper that housed the headquarters of Heroes Inc. being turned into solid gold, and the notebook that he got. He still hasn't figured out what to do with it, even though it would solve a lot of his money woes. He's like, man, all this heavy thinking, I really need a break. And so he decides he's going to swing by the hospital where his Aunt May's boyfriend Nathan is recovering. And he sneaks into a stock room and then is almost caught by a couple of nurses, has to stick to the ceiling. But once the coast is clear, he heads over, he sees Nathan, who's recovering. There's a lot of members of Aunt May's boarding house already there, just checking in with Nathan to see how he's doing. And Aunt May is happy to see him. And as he's there, a couple of the boarders, Victor and Harriet, are watching a news report. And again, we hear the name Cosmic Oneness. It's this organization. And the reporter is speaking to Barry Fox, the executive director of the cult, as she calls it. But Barry says, I wish you wouldn't refer to it as a cult. It has religious connotations, and our message is for everyone. It transcends religious boundaries. It totally has to do with the fact that each individual needs to interpret their own role in the universe. And we're all part of the same universe, and we must realize that our actions affect everyone else in the universe. And one of the Aunt May's boarders says, I really can't argue with that. And Peter thinks to himself, neither can I, but I don't understand what it is about this supposed cult that has me feeling so uneasy. Meanwhile, at the same time, at LaGuardia Airport, the Learjet belonging to Fireheart Enterprises lands, and we see that Thomas Fireheart has come to New York, and despite the fact that he has this Japanese oil deal he needs to be working on, he's here in New York to investigate the Cosmic Oneness organization. With a lot of the resources of his multi-million dollar corporation, he has discovered that the funding for this Cosmic Oneness comes from He Who Comes From Beyond. And so he's there to fulfill his destiny, even though he doesn't necessarily believe in it at that point. So meanwhile, over at the Daily Bugle, Kate Cushing, the new city editor, is trying to get more facts rather than rumor and innuendo on the cult of Cosmic Oneness. Where do they come from? What do they want? How do they support themselves? Because they have many volunteers that are handing out a few thousand dollars worth of pamphlets and buttons every day. So what's going on? What's behind it? So She assigns the stories to Ned Leeds, and then when it comes time to assign a photographer, Pete's ready and willing, but she chooses Bannon instead, Lance Bannon, and Pete's kind of put out. He's like, man, what does this girl have against me? She never gives me any assignments. She keeps choosing Lance over me. What's going on? Meanwhile, Betty Brandt and Ned Leeds are having a somewhat of a heated conversation. Their marriage seems to be on the rocks, and Betty wants to work it out, but Ned kind of walks off and leaves her in a huff, and Betty's upset. So Peter walks off thinking to himself about how Betty's really seen her marriage go down the tubes, and he never really liked Ned, but he hopes for Betty's sake that it works out, but he knows that Betty's secretly been seeing Flash Thompson. Should he say something? He's like, I don't know. She's an adult. I wouldn't want to, get involved in the middle of it. So before he knows it, Pete's at the stoop of his apartment, and Mary Jane Watson is there waiting for him. And she's like, did you forget about our date? And apparently Pete did. He said, date? He's like, yeah, don't you remember? I promised to come over and help you paint your apartment after the fire you had the other day. And that happened in Web of Spider-Man issues 11 and 12. And as Pete goes in, runs into his landlady, who Mrs. Muggins, who's always a bit curmudgeonly. And so as they head up to the apartment to paint, Pete's spider sense starts going off. When he opens the door, he finds Thomas Fireheart there already. And so he makes a quip about the decor, calling it barbecued Baroque. And Pete's left there kind of stunned. And meanwhile, Thomas Fireheart says, I'm afraid what we have to discuss is quite private, and the young lady must go. And so Mary Jane's like, man, I've never really seen someone so cool and in charge. And I think he's right, Peter. I'll see you later. And so once she leaves, Pete's like, all right, who are you? What gives you the right to break in my apartment and give orders? And Thomas Fireheart's like, control yourself. I came to make you an offer. It's a business proposition. By the way, I discovered this on top of your television set, and by my reckoning, it's worth about $37,000. You probably want to put it in a safe deposit box, as he tosses Pete the gold notebook. And Pete's again asking, who are you? And Fireheart tells him, well, we met under different circumstances before, but I'm sure you recall the name of Puma, don't you, Spider-Man? So it's clear that Thomas Fireheart knows Pete's secret identity. So meanwhile, Ned Leeds is on the street with Bannon. They're supposed to be heading off to the Cosmic Oneness organization to try to find more out about them, but he's just hanging around. Ned Leeds is just hanging around across the street from the Daily Bugle building, and Lance is like, what's going on? Why are we hanging out here? Ned says, I'm waiting for someone special. He has his suspicions. And sure enough, Betty Brant emerges from the building, and there's Flash Thompson to meet her, and they embrace, and Ned says, I've seen enough, and stomps off. So meanwhile, back in the apartment, Pete's not willing to give up his secret identity just yet. He says, let's say I am Spider-Man. You're taking an awful chance showing me your real face. And Fireheart says, there are billions of faces in the world. The odds of you recognizing mine are quite slim. But I can locate people by their individual scents. You can't. And I know you're Spider-Man, but not your real name. So why are you here, basically? To kill the Beyonder? And Thomas says, yes, if such a person truly exists. And Pete says, well, you know, I can vouch that he does exist. And Fireheart says, well, according to the legends of my people, he's destined to turn against mankind like a mad dog, and we need to kill him before it's too late. And I'm willing to offer you $5,000 as a retainer. And Pete's like, hey, I don't hire out for murder at any price. But I may not like you, but I can't let you go face the Beyonder alone. That's suicide. And so Fireheart says, well, you have an interesting dilemma. And Pete concedes that and says, well, you know, I'm going to go along with you, but I'm not making any commitments. I need to kind of assess the situation for myself. So Fireheart changes, and a few minutes later, they're out looking for the Beyonder. And again, Pete's thinking to himself, I just don't know that I agree with what this guy's trying to do. So they're heading off to the Cosmic Oneness headquarters to see what they can find out. And as they show up, Puma has plans for the building, so they're able to sneak in, and they're kind of in the ceiling, and they're looking over the director, Barry Fox, and that's where Puma's focusing his attention. Puma says, that's the man I want, and Spider-Man's not convinced. He's like, he's only the executive director. He's not the Beyonder. And Puma's like, how can you be sure? From what you told me, the Beyonder can assume any appearance he desires. And Spider-Man's like, he's right. That really could be the Beyonder. So they follow him to his office, and the Puma drops down behind him, and he raises his fist. He's ready to basically cut this guy in half. Meanwhile, Spider-Man's ready to stop him, but he thinks to himself, how do I get involved in these things? Here's this maniac about to murder somebody. I can't let him murder anybody, not even the Beyonder. But if I stop the Puma, am I condemning the human race? What if the predictions of his tribe are real, right? Like, what do I do? Meanwhile, Puma is standing behind Fox with his arm raised, ready to slice him in half. Spider-Man's trying to make a decision, but ultimately, the Puma decides on his own not to kill this man. He says, from what I can tell, this man possesses little power. If he's so different from other men, why is his heart no stronger? A swift swipe of my claws will fulfill my obligation, but how can I do this? I can't. You know, this person that stands before me is no one special. The ancient prophecies have proven false. So Spider-Man is very relieved that Fireheart decided on his own not to kill this man. And then Fox senses his presence and turns around and asks who the Puma is, and he says, I'm but a poor pilgrim who's traveled to meet the one from beyond and found him wanting. And Fox's response to that is, oh, you want the one from beyond? You must mean Frank. And Puma knows that name, right? He knows the name Frank. He knows about the whole gangster beginnings of the Beyonder that we saw in issue 2 and 3. And he says, speak of the one you call Frank. And Fox says, oh, yeah, he's a wonderful man. You know, he's the real genius behind our foundation. I'm just a chief administrator. He's the real brains. He's got a condo on the Upper West Side. Here, I'll give you the address if you wish, which I find kind of strange. Even in the 80s, not, you know, it wasn't so much different from nowadays that you would just give out home addresses of people. But apparently that's what Frank wants or what Fox feels is okay in this instance. And Spider-Man smacks himself on the forehead thinking, I went through all that soul searching for nothing. The guy wasn't even the Beyonder. So they're back on top of the roof and Puma's asking for directions. Spider-Man gives them and Puma says, wait, you're not going to accompany me? He says, no, I've had enough. You call me a wimp if you want, but today showed me that there's no way I could be any parter to bloody murder no matter what. You know, maybe it's foolish, but I'll let the Beyonder make a mistake before I go up against him again. So good luck. And Puma says, well, what about your retainer? Spider-Man says, keep it. So Puma heads across town thinking that Spider-Man's an amateur, but maybe he has a point. And his time would be better served working on that Japanese oil deal rather than chasing phantoms from beyond. But he's already come this far and he does want to please his uncle, so he continues. Once he arrives at the Beyonder's apartment, he thinks, okay, now what? Should I change into my civilian clothes and ring the doorbell? And right at that moment, the Beyonder appears in front of him and says, that won't be necessary. I already know you're here. I'm the one from beyond and you're the Puma. I've met mutants and artificially enhanced beings on this planet before, but you're very unique. None are quite like you. And immediately, the Puma begins to believe his uncle because the Beyonder's raining so much power on so many levels that Puma's hypersenses are in danger of overloading. And the Beyonder says, don't worry, I won't let you hurt yourself. And I know you're here to kill me, but since that's impossible, I don't want you to feel bad that you wasted your time, especially since you'd have preferred to be working on your business interests. So I can fix that. And he immediately transports the Puma to Tokyo. And the Puma's beside himself. He's like, Japan? Japan? Just in a blink? And a few minutes later, he arrives at the local branch of Fireheart Industries in Tokyo. And he's very perturbed because he can't even leave Japan now, right? So he's arrived in Japan through the Beyonder's powers, but he doesn't have his passport. He doesn't have the correct papers. He can't leave the country without his passport. And he can't leave the country without his passport having been stamped to show that he entered the country. So he calls his secretary back in New York and makes arrangements for his passport to be sent with the and have the proper stamps when it arrives. And then we flash forward to a week later. We're back at the apartment of Peter Parker and Mary Jane Watson is there once again. They're painting, getting things back in order after the fire. There's a knock at the door and it's Thomas Fireheart. And Mary Jane sees him or recognizes him and says, something tells me it's time to make myself scarce again. And Fireheart says, yes, thank you. Please accept this gift for the trouble. And it's a silk kimono from Japan. And so Mary Jane leaves and Peter says, Japan, what were you doing in Japan? To which Fireheart responds, well, it's a long story, Spider-Man, but suffice it to say, I met the Beyonder and he proved to be even more formidable than I imagined. So much so that I'm willing to raise your retainer to $100,000. And Spider-Man's like, what? Fireheart says, my brief encounter convinced me my uncle was right. The Beyonder is the greatest single threat to the history of mankind. Spider-Man and I must join forces to hit him with everything we've got. And Spider-Man says, have you gone psycho? There's no way to beat that guy. And Fireheart responds, they must find a way. Humanity hangs in the balance. We'll plan carefully and we'll sneak up behind him before he has a chance to defend himself. And Spider-Man's like, dude, you're nuts. He's omniscient. How do you sneak up on that guy? He's probably listening to us right now. I could just shout, hey, Beyonder, and he'd show up. And sure enough, the Beyonder then materializes right in the middle of Peter's apartment saying, yes, what do you want? Pete thinking, oh no, what have I done? And it's all to be continued in Peter Parker, the Spectacular Spider-Man, number 111. So let's move over to that comic as the story continues. Let me give the creative team really quickly here. I think I have to skip to the last. It's actually on the last page here. So it's written by Jim Owsley, which is, it was the pen name of Christopher Priest at the time. Layouts by Rich Buckler. Finishes by M. Hands, which is usually Many Hands, which is short for many different people had a hand in finishing up this issue. You can almost think of it as a bullpen issue. We've got letters by Janice Chang and colors by Nell Yomtov. So it's kind of interesting. This one starts off and Thomas Fireheart is back in Tokyo. And there's even a little blurb from Jim Shooter here at the bottom saying, in case you're wondering, scratching your head, that you've missed something, continuing from Amazing Spider-Man 273, you haven't. We've just, as I said, we jumped forward a week in Amazing Spider-Man. So we're going back a little ways here to kind of fill in the gaps. So Fireheart is here in Tokyo, standing on top of a building, the Fireheart Industries building, musing about needing to kill the Beyonder. He transforms into the Puma and he swings out across the city, thinking to himself about what a waste his entire life has been, spent training to battle somebody who could literally vaporize him on a whim. And he has to find a way to, defeat the Beyonder, basically. And so he heads 30 miles outside of town where there's a monastery where he'd done some training in the past. And he sneaks past the perimeter guards, finds the one that he's looking for. And even as he approaches him, he's attacked by three ninjas. And he says, "Greetings, silent ones. I have business with your masters. Make way or die." And they immediately attack him, but it just puts them right where he wanted them. And he easily defeats them and then calls out to Master Morimoto saying, "Face me, Master Morimoto," he yells. And Morimoto responds, "Puma, your senses are strong enough to detect a sparrow's feather landing on a still pond. Why could you not realize I was only halfway through the second side of my Duran album?" As he pulls back his hood and he's got headphones on, he's listening to his Sony Walkman. He says, "Son, you must learn patience." And the Puma is kind of chagrined at being made fun of here. And Morimoto says, "Thank you for not harming my students." And Puma says, "Of course, to do so would bring dishonor upon myself." And so Morimoto calls for some tea and asks what brings the Puma to Tokyo this time. "I sense a great uneasiness within you." And Puma begins to recount. He tells about meeting the Beyonder and the Beyonder being able to read his mind and sending him to Tokyo. And he believes that the Beyonder is a very dangerous being, and he's there looking for advice. And as the Puma tells him that he must be on his way as soon as possible to return home to face the Beyonder, Morimoto responds, "What a pity that is. He was hoping to be able to stay for a while because he has another guest who's been there for a few days and they're quite similar." And out of the shadows comes the Beyonder. And Puma says, "Wow, he's got no scent, nothing to lock onto or identify with. He could have snuck up behind me and struck me dead." Beyonder said, "Why would I need to sneak up on you to do that? I could just snap my fingers." And Puma is trying to appeal to Morimoto, saying, "Sensei, this man is dangerous. It's the being I was talking about." Morimoto says, "Yes, so I assumed. Karami, or the Beyonder, as you call him, is an old friend. We've had many discussions of late, mostly about you." And the Beyonder tries to convince Puma, "I'm not dangerous. The greatest danger here is your fear of me. Let me explain where I came from, and maybe then you'll get the message." And the Beyonder takes Morimoto and Puma on a trip. He shows them the universe that he first existed in, where he was all in that universe. He shows him the events of Secret Wars, the first 12-issue miniseries, when the heroes and villains battled. He explains about falling in love with Dazzler and then feeling incomplete when she didn't reciprocate those feelings. He speaks of meeting Doctor Strange and learning about the way that Doctor Strange took the path to fulfillment and enlightenment and contentment, and about how he's trying to find his role in the universe, and he believes that role is now to help others achieve their desires and their fulfillment. And that's why the Beyonder is there with Morimoto, and why he sent Puma to Japan in the first place, because the Puma really should be looking after his tribe and defending it from the threats, as well as directing Fireheart Industries. And Beyonder goes on to say, "You're wasting your time trying to recruit help to destroy me, and you should go home and stop wasting your energy." But the Puma's not convinced. He says, "I'll go, Beyonder, but only to gather means and forces to destroy you." And the Beyonder sighs with disappointment, saying, "You still don't get it, do you? I'm only trying to help you." But the Puma says, "No, I don't need your help. I'll see you dead, Beyonder," and walks off. And the Beyonder says to Morimoto, "Do you believe that guy?" And Morimoto's response is, "Do you truly know who that is?" And the Beyonder says, "Well, I know what I want to know." And Morimoto says, then I suggest you learn everything there is to know about the Puma, because you've just set events in motion that are going to lead to a catastrophic end. So meanwhile, New York, the next morning at dawn, Peter's sitting on top of a building, still thinking about the fact that Jean DeWolf is dead. Aunt May's boyfriend Nathan's in the hospital. Dominic Fortune's on a plane to gosh knows where, looking for his lost love. You know, all these terrible things are going on, and the thing they all have in common is they're all unlucky enough to encounter him, right? Peter Parker, the not so spectacular Spider-Man, and he's just thinking about his you know, apartment's on fire, the Slade character, and Jonah Jameson being attacked, and he's really not feeling too good. But he hears some sirens to kind of distract him out of his moping and his kind of wallowing in self-pity. He says, "Oh, well, I still got to pay my bills. So if there's sirens, that means cops, and cops means crimes, and that means photos, and maybe I can get out of my own head and pay some bills." So he swings off in pursuit of the sirens. He sees a van that's driving out of control. A couple cop cars crash into each other. And meanwhile, a few blocks ahead, we see Maud and Ralph in a car, and they're arguing. They're supposed to be handing out pamphlets for the Cosmic Oneness, and Ralph just wants to go play tennis. And the van sideswipes them, and the car spins out of control. Spider-Man's able to stop both the van and the station wagon from doing any further damage to anybody. But unfortunately, Maud wasn't wearing her seatbelt, and she appears to be injured very badly. So much later, Peter Parker's apartment, Mary Jane is there helping him paint. And this is the scene we saw at the end of Amazing Spider-Man, where Thomas Fireheart shows up, gifts the kimono to Mary Jane, and she leaves, offers Spider-Man the $100,000 retainer. Spider-Man says he could be listening right now. "You're crazy," shouts out the "Hey, Beyonder," and the Beyonder shows up and says, "What do you want?" And Fireheart's response is, "You know what I want." And the Beyonder says, "You still don't get it, right? You should be more like Spider-Man here. He's filled with dozens of conflicts and self-doubt, blames himself for things that he wasn't responsible for. But all things considered, he's in pretty good shape, right? He knows his role in the scheme of things. He's Spider-Man. He's a champion of life. He protects his family, his friends. He's got a deep commitment and sense of responsibility. And those things aren't going to fail him." And Spider-Man, despite what's going on here with the Beyonder and Fireheart, Puma is thinking, you know, he's got a point. He starts feeling a little better about himself. And so the Beyonder continues. He's like, "Let me offer you another example, Puma, someone a lot closer to you, someone who I finally convinced was wasting their time, and they finally embraced their true role in the universe." And he summons Morimoto. Morimoto, the old master, who now is wearing a leather jacket and boots and ripped jeans, anarchy t-shirt, a big orange afro, and he's holding a guitar. And he says to Puma, "Ah, Puma, it is me. You've known my fondness for rock music for quite some time. Why are you surprised?" He said, "What has the Beyonder done to you?" "Said, nothing. He merely spoke and I listened. It's time that I fulfilled my heart's desire." And Puma says, "Sensei, I will avenge this outrage." And the Beyonder says, "There's nothing to avenge. One of my Cosmic Oneness devotees owns a nightclub, and Morimoto is booked there tonight, so I'll see you later." And he walks off. And Puma's like, turns to Spider-Man and says, "This had to convince you." Spider-Man says, "Yes, I am convinced. I think the Beyonder's right. Is what he's asking so terrible that we just let ourselves be ourselves? And Fireheart stalks off saying, Sensei, isn't the Beyonder a threat? Absolutely, the Beyonder is the greatest threat to the known universe that is if he wishes to be. But the Beyonder is neither benevolent or malevolent. But even if you wanted to destroy him, there isn't anything any of us can do to stop him. The Puma's not having it. He's like, you people are pathetic. I'm the only sane man left. And he leaves. And Spider-Man's trying to convince him, hey, you know, that's not the way to go. But Morimoto says, you're wasting your time trying to talk him out of it. He's convinced that the Beyonder is to be destroyed. Well, meanwhile, the Beyonder's purpose is to show others their role in the scheme of things. But the Puma's purpose is to protect his tribe. And technically, the Beyonder has the potential to be the greatest threat to that tribe. So therefore, in order for the Beyonder to fulfill the desire of Puma and end incompleteness in Puma, he must fulfill his role in the universe and kill the Beyonder. So it's almost a catch-22, right? In order for the Beyonder to help Puma fulfill his role, Puma's got to have the power to kill the Beyonder. So it's this kind of vicious cycle. And as the page turns, we see the Beyonder speaking to Death and talking about what Morimoto was just saying, right? And actually being afraid and wondering why he's afraid. It's like, you know, I vanquished Death at one point and you have so many faces and so many names, and yet I'm the most powerful being in the universe. I'm aware of everything, and with a thought I could basically destroy the universe. But something has changed, and I need to be whole. I need to find out how to do that, how to be whole, how to once again feel contentment and feel complete. And in order to do that, I have to let the Puma fulfill his destiny, even though the destiny is for me to die at his hand. And would that be so bad? Or would it be so bad if I failed, right? He succeeded with Morimoto. He succeeded with Spider-Man. But really, the Puma is the greatest challenge. So I've got to let him fulfill his destiny and embrace what that destiny means, even if it means my death. But again, being that I'm the most powerful being in existence, why am I afraid? Meanwhile, outside the hospital where Maud was taken after the accident, we see Ralph Macchio show up, and we find out that he has made a vow to kill the Beyonder because he blames the Organization of Cosmic Oneness for the death of his wife. Because if it wouldn't have been for the fact they were supposed to be handing out those pamphlets in Midtown, they never would have been there in the first place. So over at the Daily Bugle, Kate Cushing sees this and says, wow, we really need to cover all angles of this cosmic oneness story. And a great side piece would be about this nightclub that this Ralph Macchio guy owns and his wife dying. So she sends Joy Mercado and Pete off to get the story about that. And so they make plans to go to the nightclub that night. And Joy says, be sure you wear something better than what you have on now. You look like a narc. And Peter's like, wow, at least Joy seems to have her head in the right place, but I wish I could get the Puma and Beyonder business off my mind. And as he walks into the men's room, the Beyonder's there saying, I sense your thoughts, Spider-Man. And Pete's like, oh, for crying out loud. He says, don't worry. I'm not going to allow anyone to overhear us. And Pete goes on to say, but, you know, Morimoto clued me into this suicide pact you've got with Puma. Why not call it off? What's there to prove? There's got to be some other person you could help find their true role. And the Beyonder says, well, there is, but there's nobody. I've scanned the globe for a greater challenge than the Puma, and there's no one else. No one else even comes close. But I'm very tired. I'm weary of mind more than body, and I wish I could get out of it at this point, but this incompleteness eats at me like cancer. I must have some purpose, some role. And by allowing others to fulfill their role, maybe I'll start feeling some sense of accomplishment, even if by helping Puma fulfill his role, it means my destruction, right? So I've got to let this happen. So meanwhile, at Fireheart Industries, we see that Fireheart, Thomas Fireheart, is trying to take a different tack to go after the organization of Cosmic Oneness, tried to find out some IRS business kind of things, but everything's on the up and up, and there's really nothing he can do on that front. So he makes up his mind that it must be a physical confrontation, and he transforms into the Puma. So meanwhile, at the nightclub that evening, Morimoto is on stage playing with his band. We see Peter and Joy show up. We see the Puma show up, and we see the owner of the club, Ralph Macchio, show up and spot the Beyonder and head toward him, pulling out a gun. And Morimoto, despite him fulfilling his role, being this musician in the universe, Morimoto can't help but fall back into his old ways. And he leaps in front of the Beyonder at the last moment and is shot. And this infuriates Puma. He's like, if you had just left him alone, he would have been in Tokyo. He would have been alive. And it seems like the Beyonder might be able to save Morimoto. But when the Puma interrupts, I guess then it's too late, because he does mention that you sacrificed yourself for nothing. Ralph's bullet couldn't have hurt me. And all you had to do was play. But I can heal this up really quickly. But again, he never does, and I assume it's because the Puma interrupted him. So meanwhile, Pete has to act like a coward and run away, despite Joy staying there to try to get the story. But obviously, Pete's going to change into Spider-Man. And as he's outside changing, there's a loud noise. And when he returns, the Puma seems much larger than he was previously, has a lot more power. And because previously Spider-Man had been able to kind of hold his own with the Puma, but that's not the case here. The Puma swats Spider-Man aside like he's nothing. He breaks his webbing like it's nothing. And at that point, Spider-Man realizes that this new form of Puma is far too strong and powerful. It's time to cut and run. He grabs the Beyonder and tries to get him to safety. And what's happening here basically is, again, the Beyonder is trying to help Puma fulfill his role. And in order for Puma to fulfill his role and destroy the Beyonder had to basically allow Puma to become more powerful. So the Beyonder has literally given Puma the power to destroy the Beyonder. So the Beyonder is almost enabling his own destruction, because he feels like this is what needs to be done for him to finally feel complete. Like if he can help the person on the planet who he senses most needs his help to fulfill his destiny and his role, then the Beyonder will have fulfilled his role. And in that sense, everything will be complete. It will close the circle. So when Spider-Man grabs Beyonder and tries to get him to safety, the Beyonder zaps him and says, you know, you need to let this happen. Spider-Man's like, are you on drugs? Puma will waste you. And the Beyonder says, exactly. And Spider-Man's like, you guys are nuts. I don't want to be around for the bloodbath. The truth is, I can't tell the difference between reality when the Beyonder is manipulating me. And obviously, you can't either, Puma. And Puma's like, wait, manipulating? Am I playing right into the Beyonder's hands? And the Beyonder standing right there in front of Puma and saying, well, Puma, get it over with. And Fireheart makes his decision and swipes at the Beyonder. And as he swipes, we see him shrink and lose that power. And it's just a small swipe that rips the Beyonder's clothes. And Puma says, the power, what happened? And the Beyonder explains, well, you doubted momentarily. You doubted your role. And at that moment, you were out of harmony with the universe. Puma, we have both failed. The blow you struck was a mighty one, but even the mightiest Puma blow couldn't kill me. Looks like I'm back to square one. And he disappears. And Puma is standing there with the body of Morimoto at his feet, having failed. So just Spider-Man put that doubt in his mind momentarily that perhaps he was being manipulated. Perhaps the Puma wasn't fulfilling his destiny after all. And that little moment of doubt, that little hesitation was enough to throw everything out of sync. And I don't know that the Puma showed up again in Spider-Man books. I imagine that he has. This era of Spider-Man, the mid-80s, is when I was reading a lot of Spider-Man. I remember the Puma. And a lot of what I remember of the Puma is this Beyonder storyline. So I don't know how this may have affected him, how this may have affected his self-confidence and who he was as a hero going forward. But it's, when you think about it, it's a pretty crappy thing to do, right? Like, you had this ability, you had this destiny to accomplish it, and then one little split second of doubt, and it all gets thrown away in a manner of speaking. And for the Beyonder, he sums it up perfectly himself when he says, it looks like it's back to square one, back to trying to find a purpose in the universe. All right, so the other two issues, like I mentioned, I'm going to talk about New Mutants 36 first. Let me give the creative team. It's written by Chris Claremont. We have art by Mary Wilshire and Bill Sienkiewicz, with colors by Michael Higgins and letters by Tom Orzechowski. That's not easy to say. And as I said, the Beyonder's role in this issue is kind of inconsequential. Basically, what happens in this issue is it's focused on Ilya Rasputin, who is magic, right? And she, you know, when she's a child, she got kidnapped to the dark dimension, as she calls it, mentored by Belasco. And she has that dark side of her persona, the dark child persona, that allows her to use magic. And she has the Eldritch armor and the, you know, the mystical medallion and the soul sword. And she uses all that to keep the dark dimension at bay. She's the kind of the empress, the queen of the dark dimension. And she makes sure that the demons that are there stay there and they don't attack our world. And it's kind of her destiny in a way, her lot in life, her, you know, cross to bear, whatever analogy you want to use. And she's good at it, but she does have this dark side to her persona that allows her to wield these weapons and this magic and keep the monsters at bay, so to speak. And so, you know, on the heels of issue number 7 of Secret Wars, with the Beyonder wanting to fulfill a role, we saw in issue 1 when the Beyonder confronted Ilyana, he sensed that duality. He sensed that other existence within her, the dark child persona, and called it forth, and it caused some issues. And the only other person able to wield the dark sword, Kitty Pryde, ended up having to rescue the New Mutants and kind of snap Ilyana out of her dark child persona while they were in the limbo dark dimension. And and so the Beyonder in this issue, when he appears before Ilyana, speaks to that, like, yeah, you know, ever since I first met you and knew about the dark child persona within you, I was always curious about what it is. Like, I want to know what will be, you know, I want to restore order to chaos. And you have that dark soul self inside you, and you call it evil and you fear it. But what I want to do is restore the natural order of things. Like, what would happen had you never had that dark child persona, right? And so he basically removes it from her. At that point, the soul sword, the Eldritch armor, the medallion, they all transfer to Kitty. But Kitty doesn't have that. She didn't go through the training that magic went through, that Ilyana went through in limbo. So she's not, and she doesn't have that dark child persona to help her make the most of these abilities. So what happens in the issue is these demons start manifesting, these creatures from limbo, and Kitty is not successfully able to repel them. And meanwhile, Ilyana has now become almost this acolyte or this disciple of the Beyonder. She's almost brainwashed in a way, like, oh, it's okay that these demons are attacking, because in the bigger scheme of things, what matters is order and like oneness and being happy. And she's able to convince Sam Cannonball from the New Mutants by touching him and being in proximity with him. And Sam explains it as, talks about Arthur C. Clarke's novel, with this race called the Overlords, who came to Earth to help humanity, and join the universe to the consciousness named the Overmind. And that's what the Beyonder wants. He's like the Overlord and Overmind combined. He wants everybody to, you know, join hands and sing Kumbaya and be one. And the New Mutants are like, that's all great that you think that, but we're not about to join some cult, because that's exactly what it sounds like. What's more important to us is the fact that these demons are breaking down the barrier and they're popping up all over the place, and they're going to attempt their age-old desire to conquer Earth. And again, Ileana's like, eh, it's no big deal. They can't hold a candle to the Beyonder and his plans for what's truly important. And they're like, what are you talking about? Can you really think that? She's like, yeah, don't worry about it. Just take my hand and I'll show you like the truth, right? And the New Mutants are like, no, we don't know what's wrong with you, Ileana, but we're not about to touch you or let you brainwash us like the Beyonder has brainwashed you. And so there's a really short fight as Ileana tries to convince the other New Mutants. But before they can really resolve things, another larger demon shows up and is literally wearing Kitty around its neck as a charm, right? Because again, she was inexperienced and she wasn't able to defeat this larger demon that's invading the Earth. And so the New Mutants are trying to fight it off. They're not very successful. And Ileana's kind of standing there. She's not really engaged. And Danny Moonstone's like, she's your best friend. How can you stand by and watch her slaughtered? And she's like, for the Beyonder, the greater good. She's like, Danny says, are you saying Kitty isn't important, that she doesn't matter? And so then Ileana has a choice to make, right? She's like, Kitty would do anything for me. Can I not do the same? She's there. She took my place and my responsibility. And in order to take them back, to take the ability back, the power back, I've got to become evil again, right? I've got to basically take the Dark Child persona back. But if I do that, I'm inviting evil in, and how can I call myself good? But how can I call myself good if I let Kitty die, right? So she ultimately decides to take the power back, and she wants to cry because she took the evil, her evil self, this evil version of herself, this Dark Child persona, back into herself of her own free will, and she feels like because of that, she will never be free of it. And so they manage to defeat the demon. They stop the invasion, and Kitty ends up being okay. And Ileana really made quite a sacrifice. But again, to me, this story, the Beyonder, doesn't play as big of a role, because you could have, I mean, he was just a plot device, right? He was just a way for Chris Claremont to say, okay, what would happen if Ileana, I mean, you can almost make it a what if issue. What would happen if Ileana hadn't become Dark Child? And we see the consequences in this issue. But you just as easily, without using the Beyonder, could have just had Ileana find a way on her own to kind of expel or reject that Dark Child side of her persona with the same results. So didn't necessarily think the Beyonder was necessary for this story. And the other thing is, like, so it doesn't necessarily dovetail in with him wanting to help people fulfill their roles. It's almost diametrically opposed to that. It's almost the exact opposite, right? Because it's clear by what happens in this issue that Ileana is destined or fated, or what her role is to be the defense from Limbo, to protect the Earth from Limbo and the demons that live there. So yeah, not exactly sure how much this one plays into the Beyonder fulfilling his role or fulfilling the role of helping others fulfill their role. So the last issue I'm going to talk about is the New Defenders 152. The most interesting thing I find about this issue is the fact that it's the final issue. You know, part of the reason that these crossovers happen, you know, we speculate, is that you're trying to get readers that are reading the main event to pick up books they wouldn't normally read and discover new characters and new titles that then the publisher hopes they'll keep reading, right? Well, clearly that's not the case here, because this is the final issue of the Defenders. So people could read this and be like, oh, I love this team, let me get more. I guess you're going to go back and buy back issues, right? Which publisher doesn't get that money, because there's no more future issues. And again, in this issue, much like New Mutants, the Beyonder's just a plot device. He's very tangential to the story. And this is a double-sized issue. I was never a big fan of the Defenders, at least not this version of it, with Angel, Beast, Iceman, Valkyrie, and Gargoyle. I think when they first appeared, it was like Nighthawk, Doctor Strange, Ghost Rider, and Hulk, I want to say. Or I might be getting them mixed up with the Champions. Not 100% sure. I know Ghost Rider, Doctor Strange and Hulk for sure, and Nighthawk. But be that as it may, I was never a big fan of this later version of the Defenders. And this is a really long story. And being that the Beyonder doesn't play a huge role, I'm not going to go in and break down, page by page. I'll just kind of explain the story in broad strokes. So the issue opens up with Moondragon, who previously had been a member of the Defenders, and she's been possessed by this evil dragon, and she's fighting against the Defenders. And Moondragon was always a character who kind of straddled good and bad. She always struggled to control her mystical powers, and some of those powers kind of corrupted her at times and put her on the wrong side of the line. But here, with the help of a few others, the Defenders are able to defeat her, and she kind of sulks off, and she's kind of off licking her wounds. And one of the comrades of the Defenders that were able to help her be defeated is named Manslaughter, and he literally has the power to drive you insane, like literally insane. And more so than being defeated, that's what Moondragon fears the most, being losing her mind, losing control of her mind. And so when she runs off, she doesn't want to, she's kind of no longer bonded with the dragon, or at least not fully bonded. And the dragon wants to bond and use her power and use his powers and go back and fight again. But Moondragon's had enough. She's like, no, I won't be driven insane. It's too much of a risk. I won't do it. And so then the dragon says, well, I sense there's someone on this earth right now that has a lot of power. Power beyond anything else that you could even imagine. And merely by speaking his name, he can come and give us the power that we need, and then we know we'll be successful. So Moondragon calls out for the Beyonder. He does show up, and in his presence, she seems to be clearer of mind and look much more normal, and state how she will be a good disciple and will do good on the Beyonder's behalf. And he seems to buy this. And says, give me your hand. And in the hand is the dragon, which seems very small at this point, almost as if it's been vanquished. And the Beyonder doesn't take the time to examine it or really understand what's going on, which is kind of strange, being that he's omniscient. You would think he would know. But instead, he turns the dragon into a ring that he places on Moondragon's finger as a token, so people will know that she is his disciple. So once he leaves, the dragon exerts its will over Moondragon once again, and she's off to kill the Defenders. So ultimately, a few of the Defenders sacrifice themselves to vanquish Moondragon, and Moondragon herself, the good part of her, manages to manifest itself and help with the resolution of the story as well. So there are many people that make a heroic sacrifice here, but I don't know. It rings a little hollow. It's not particularly great storytelling. And again, I don't know that the Beyonder was completely necessary. I suppose he did amplify the power of the dragon and Moondragon to the point where those heroic sacrifices were made. But I feel like you could have done it just as easily without him. You could have had the dragon, this dragon that had its roots in the time of King Arthur in the Marvel Universe. You could have had him draw power from somewhere else, or just have Moondragon more fully integrate or allow the dragon to fully integrate with her, and their power could have been magnified that way. So again, I'm just not sure how necessary the Beyonder was to the story. And there's no real mention in this issue of him helping her fulfill her destiny. She just says, I want to be your disciple and do good. And he says, okay, will you be a good disciple? Okay, then here's some power. So again, I'm just not not sure that he was necessary for the story, and not sure how necessary the crossover was at all, because as I mentioned, this is the final issue of Defenders. So it's not like you're going to convince people to pick up subsequent issues of the book. So I don't know, maybe the creative team over on the Defenders just wanted their turn. Like, everyone else gets to crossover, why can't we? I can't speak to that, but it's definitely an issue you can skip. Anyway, I want to thank everyone for joining. Please tell your friends about us. Subscribe and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platform you use. The ratings really help with our ability to reach listeners, especially 5-star reviews on iTunes. Also, all past episodes of the podcast are available on all those platforms, as well as at lrmonline.com. While you're at the site, please check out all the other pop culture coverage of your favorite upcoming movies and TV shows. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. The next show I'll be at is Long Beach Comic Con in Long Beach, California on Saturday, September the 8th. So if you're going to be there, please let me know. Be great to meet up with you, hear what you like about the show, and hook you up with a free Comic Source lanyard. So once again, I want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.